psychology from the University of Illinois in Chicago. The focus of his dissertation research was on sex-relevant connections of the medial preoptic area using a combination of immunochemical and track tracing techniques. In 2009, Dr. Struthers published a book with InterVarsity Press entitled Wired for Intimacy: How Pornography Hijacks the Male Brain. He has contributed book chapters on the topics of gaming and pornography addiction and faith and science issues, and has published several articles on topics at the interface between psychology and neuroscience. In 2006, he was awarded the Junior Faculty Achievement Award by Wheaton College. Today, Dr. Struthers will be speaking to us about the reproductive brain, neurosexism, and the ethics of sexuality.
Good afternoon. I must confess that this is not how I anticipated celebrating my 41st birthday. So when I saw the schedule, I thought it was kind of funny. Thank you. Well, if you have spent any time at the Barnes & Nobles down the street or maybe at your local bookstore, you may have seen some of these Scientific American issues, His Brain, Her Brain, Your Sexual Brain. You may have come across Lou Anne Brizendine's books, The Male Brain and The Female Brain. There on the right, you can see the female brain being a tangle of old-fashioned telephone cord wire shaped in the form of a brain, and a man's being a bundle of duct tape all wrapped up. You may have also, if you spent any time looking at the scientific literature, seen that there has been an increase in the number of publications looking at fMRIs and DTI and SPECT studies, where they are looking at differences between men and women's brains on any number of different cognitive and behavioral and sensory systems. Well, I was asked to share a little bit about the sexual brain. And when you talk about sex, oftentimes people will sort of go to male and female. And what I have found is helpful in the conversation is to think about sex as having a variety of different levels. Now, of course, with any good... Oops, sorry. Oh, thank you. It's my birthday, so I get a special microphone. All right. Or maybe I'm just speaking too loudly. So when you talk with social scientists, and certainly when you talk with anthropologists, they want to make the distinction between sex and gender. Sex, for the biologist among us, is going to be more associated with reproductive status, whereas gender is much more socially constructed or socially delineated differences within a community about what is masculine and what is feminine. Now, what I found to be helpful is this model. This model may not seem helpful, but let me walk you through it just for a second. If we think about sex as having a variety of different levels, we can start at the lowest level with genetics. Now, certainly we have XX is female and XY is male, but we know that there are other genetic statuses that a person can have. Turner syndrome, for example. A woman can have an X chromosome from her mother, but not receive one from the sperm from her father. So this does not mean that she's not fully female. It just means that her genetic status is different than it would be for a woman who has XX. Also, there is XXX. There is also XYY. There's any number of different genetic sexual states that a person can have. But in the normal course of development, your genetic status is going to influence the undifferentiated tissue of the gonads. So you will have what's called a gonadal sex. As a general rule, men will have testes and women will have ovaries. And during the course of development, these gonads will release gender-specific hormones, such as testosterone or estrogen and progesterone, and they will create a hormonal milieu. Now, during the course of development, once again, this is still sort of intrauterine, right? This is in the womb that this is going on. You'll find that the hormones that are produced or not produced by the gonads will be released into the developing fetus's system. And these hormones will, as you notice here on the left, go over to that little diamond shape there, these hormones are critically important, especially in the male, in the development of the reproductive organs, those organs in the body and the systems in the body that are designed for the creation of offspring. And there are two sets of tissue here. We have the tissue that's on the outside of the body, the external phenotype, and we also have the tissue that's on the inside of the body, the internal phenotype. So when we talk about the reproductive status of an individual, really, it's getting a little more complicated here, isn't it? It's not just about your genes. It's not just about your gonads. It's not just about your hormones. It's not even about your plumbing, so to speak. Because you can have an external phenotype that is sort of inconsistent with your internal phenotype. That's not, I shouldn't say it's common, but it's not unheard of either. But in most cultures, what happens is a baby's born and they look between its legs and they look at the external phenotype and they assign a gender to it. They say, oh, it's a boy or it's a girl. But we also know that hormones aren't smart. Hormones kind of go throughout the system, and hormones will influence other, they're on the right, non-reproductive organs, the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the bones. And what we do see is that there are some different morphological differences between men and women. Subtle, they're not as different as, for example, the external phenotype is, but there are some subtle differences here. And it's believed that these hormones early in development can be critical for the way that the heart is built in boys as opposed to girls. Well, these non-reproductive organs, I've kind of put them into two big categories here. The non-neurological, which means bone, muscle, heart, liver, kidneys, all that kind of fun stuff. And, of course, the more interesting one, as far as I'm concerned, which is the neurological, the brain and the spinal cord. But if we can move from thinking of the brain as a singular organ, but having multiple different parts, which are affected by hormones at different seasons of time, we can perhaps consider how these hormones early in development might influence any number of different brain regions, moving from the 3 o'clock position counterclockwise. Perhaps the presence of testosterone early on in development can be part of the reason why we see there are some sensory differences between men and women. We do know that, for example, in the thalamus, that with diffusion tensor imaging, that men and women have very subtly different connections between some of the subthalamic nuclei and the way that they form connections. So men and women, to a certain extent, do see the world differently. They feel the world differently. We see that there are some subtle autonomic differences in the way that men and women respond to stress. Whether it be with an elevation of cortisol or adrenaline, or the way in which neurologically signals are, a threat stimulus. For example, many men will aggress towards a threat stimulus. Many women will retreat from a threat stimulus. And that's tied into the fight or flight sort of autonomic processes. May very well be possible that some of these early developmental hormones are responsible for behavioral differences or cognitive differences, the often cited, right, men are good at math, women are good with language kind of stereotype that we hear often floated out there. But you do see that there are some small differences between some of these behavioral and cognitive processes that men and women have. Also, emotionally, affectively, that there may be some subtle differences that are rooted in this early release of hormones during development. But it's really around these last four that things really start getting interesting. When we start talking about gender identity, right, the way that a person thinks of themselves, as Dr. Lloyd mentioned in the previous talk, there is just beginning to be neurological research at looking at the difference between gay, straight, and transgendered individuals and what's going on in their brains. What, is the brain of a transgendered person? I like to joke with my students, they assume that I'm a heterosexual man, but I could very well be a transgendered lesbian. Couldn't I? I mean, from the outside, we kind of laugh a little bit at that. Well, if I think of myself as a woman who is sexually attracted to other women, then it's not a problem for me to be married to a woman. And I just have the added bonus of being able to foster biological children with her. Whereas if I really was a woman who was a lesbian and married to another lesbian woman, we'd need some technological intervention in order to make that happen. So gender identity is inherently sort of reproductive, but not, right? So the way that you think of yourself as a transgendered person doesn't prohibit you from procreating. Now, we also have the issue of sexual response. The way that a person responds to sexual cues can vary. My wife and I do some premarital counseling, and although my wife uses this analogy, I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with it, but I'll share it with you because this is a safe place. She says that when it comes to sex, men are like microwaves and women are like crockpots. That the response is different in the way that women go about doing that. And even within, for example, with men, you can see that you can alter the way that they respond based on their experience. That men who regularly view pornography and sexually act out to it will alter the way that they can respond to a real woman when they are actually with a real woman. So sexual response can be teased away from sexual attraction, or perhaps think of it as sexual orientation. That is, what are the cues that trigger sexual arousal? What are you drawn to? Sexual orientation, right there, and sexual arousal, which are the specific cues. So say, for example, my wife is a certain size and a shape and certain facial features that I find attractive. And other women who don't have those features, I'm not necessarily aroused by them. So when we think about all of these things going on in the brain, we can kind of move to this notion of the sexual brain. And oftentimes, I like to use this flight of an arrow analogy, that there are developmental effects, as seen previously here. Early in development, these hormones can bathe the fetus, bathe the the child going through puberty, to alter the way that these brains are morphologically built, the way that these brain regions are structured, the size of these cells, their volume, also the manner in which they make connections. We know that during puberty, that testosterone, one of the things that it does is it prunes some connections. And also the manner in which these cells are activated. So we've got sexual differences in morphology, circuitry, and activation that can be the part of sort of a bottom-up process whereby hormones build the sexual brain. We also know that the brain is incredibly influenced by experience as well, that the things that the environment does, where the trajectory of the arrow might be hormonal, the way that the wind blows the arrow is the environment working on the brain as well. The brain is a wonderfully plastic organ, as mentioned earlier by Dr. Jones. So the things that happen to you can change the size of your brain. The things that happen to you can influence your circuitry. The things that happen to you can influence the way in which these circuits are activated. And I would also argue the things that you think about and you dwell on can change morphology, circuitry, and activity. So just thinking about that, it's easy to see this as a bottom-up process, but we also want to acknowledge that there's a bidirectionality to this system as well. Now, I can't think myself into having an extra X chromosome, right? But the things that I ruminate about can, as the epigeneticists will tell us, change the way in which my genome is able to manifest itself in adulthood. So developmentally, we have this bottom-up approach, but also psychologically, we have a top-down approach, which gives us this bidirectionality of the sexual brain. Now, instead of thinking of the sexual brain, because of this many, multi-layered brain regions here, with different brain regions having different periods of susceptibility to hormones and experience, perhaps rather than talking about the male brain and the female brain as if they are external genitalia brains, right? Perhaps a better way to think about it is a sexual mosaic brain, with each part of the brain having its own tile that varies from a very, very dark, we'll say masculine, to a very, very white, feminine. And so we can have lots of shades of gray, sometimes darker patches of black, sometimes lighter patches of white, with both men and women able to have any range of different colors here. So this neurological mosaic really gives us, when we take into consideration hormonal trajectories, when we take into consideration environmental factors, when we take into consideration that the brain is perhaps the most plastic organ that we have in our bodies, able to modify itself, well, now we've got a really complex way to think about human sexuality that goes beyond just some of the gender differences that we see, or beyond these kind of politically volatile issues of human sexual identity. Now, as a Christian, as a person of faith, Protestant Christian, maybe I should be more careful about using that term, thinking about sexuality, it is tied to our embodied nature. There is a certain level of differentiation that is necessary. We don't want to move to a place where we try to have completely androgynous individuals. We want to acknowledge that male and female are different, and they have to be different in order for life to come about. So when we focus on these neurological, psychological differences, whether it be orientation or identity or arousal and response patterns, you know, cognitive, behavioral, affective differences, we need to find ways to move beyond saying that, no, that really sex isn't important, or sort of making sex the only important thing in the conversation. And unfortunately, what we have in our culture now, I just saw an article, I think it was last night online, where they looked at the episodes of Friends. You guys remember the Friends television sitcom? Apparently, on average, each of the cast members had like over 14 different sexual partners. And we think about the way that our culture, those outside of the walls of the church, talk about sexuality. Yeah, they'll talk about it being reproductive, but they talk about it being, you know, it's novel. And much in my field, you know, this notion of novelty is finding new partners, that males have a particular mating strategy and women have a different mating strategy. And that's why we do the things that we do, is becoming increasingly common. And this is what brings us to the topic of neurosexism. Cordelia Fine, in 2008, wrote an article in Neuroethics. I think it was entitled, yeah, Will Working Mothers' Brains Explode? I thought that was a rather interesting article. And in it, she described the rush to cloak old-fashioned sexism in the respectable and authoritative language of neuroscience as this process by which neuroscience was being used to explain differences between men and women. And I went down to the Barnes & Noble down the street. They do have this book. About 3 or 4 months ago, there was a book entitled A Billion Wicked Thoughts by Yogi Agassi and Sai Gautam, a computational neuroscientist who went onto many AOL and other search engines and visited a number of pornographic websites looking at the things that men and women search for. And interestingly, even though there's a lot of good science in it, there's also some of this neurosexism as well. And they came to the conclusion that women are Miss Marple and men are Elmer Fudd when it comes to issues of desire. They write this with respect to women. For a woman, context is everything. The detective agency, that's the decision-making systems in her brain, the detective agency's decision-making process is often experienced as female intuition, a gut sense that a particular guy is Mr. Right or Mr. Wrong. This is the subjective outcome of Miss Marple's evaluation of the complex array of clues gathered by the emotional, social, and cultural detectives, combined with an evaluation of a potential mate's physical attractiveness to produce a simple answer to the profoundly complex question, should I or shouldn't I? Should I marry Tom or wait until he gets a better job? Should I sleep with this hot guy I just met at the club? A woman's mind is filled with difficult choices, the result of Miss Marple's endless sleuthing. Now, this is contrasted with men being described as Elmer Fudd. Solitary, quick to arouse, goal-targeted, driven to hunt, and a little foolish. In other words, the male brain's desire software is like Elmer Fudd. Fudd, the comic foil of Bugs Bunny in the Looney Tunes cartoons, is always on the hunt for a specific target, rabbits, or as Fudd says, wabbits. Fudd is a solitary hunter who likes to work alone. Fudd is trigger happy. The moment he sees a wabbit, or he thinks he sees a wabbit, he squeezes the trigger and fires. Fudd is easily fooled by ducks dressed up as rabbits and other tricks played on him by Bugs Bunny. But even when Fudd shoots his gun at a phony rabbit, he never gets discouraged. He reloads and gets back out there. Tomorrow's another day for the hunt, another chance to bag a wabbit. Now, this sounds an awful lot like the neurosexism that I'm describing, and I think that Dr. Fine is describing as well. Now, if we want to stay in this place where we acknowledge the real differences between men and women and not to kind of go overboard, we can see how these differences neurologically in the way that men and women are wired, hardwired and softwired, have profound implications for the way that we kind of explore into this next world, which we're describing as neuroethics. Neuroethics is a popular new community among both scientists and philosophers and medical professionals, looking at what are the implications for how the brain works on things such as moral judgments. if men and women are wired differently. I think there was an article in The Atlantic a few months ago where they conducted a study where men are much more likely to make black and white ethical decisions or categorical decisions. Women are much more likely to make sort of gray judgments in their decisions. Well, how does that play out when it comes to the questions of morality? With respect to empathy, in women being much more likely to empathize, men being much less likely to empathize. Is one always better? Is compassion always the right response so that we let the criminals get away with what they want to do as long as they're saying they're sorry? Or is there a certain element of detachment? How does rationality play into these questions? The question of agency. If men and women's hormone levels influence the way that they think, what implication does that have for a woman as she goes through her menstrual cycle? And forget the fact that men go through 4 or 5 of their own hormonal cycles across the day. What do we do with that? What do we do with that when it comes to assigning agency and the way that agency is incorporated within the context of the legal system and responsibility? So with neurosexism, we do have this range. We have this spectrum of differences between men and women. Some of them may be due to hormonal factors that push us away from each other. Some of them may be cultural differences that push us away from each other. And there may be ways that we can use these forces to perhaps avoid the extremes, avoiding becoming overly masculine or overly feminine, but also to appreciate and value the feminine, to appreciate and value the masculine, and not say that one is inherently better than the other. Nor would we want to say that we would want to find the perfect balance of masculine and feminine and that all should aspire to that sort of an androgynous view of what it means to be human. And these arguments, this conversation, which we're trying to move towards a conversation away from an argument, what you find is a great deal of suspicion that depending on whether you're sort of on the nature side or the nurture side, there's going to be a lot of judging of the books that are out there. For example, the Leonard Sachs and the Luann Brizendines of the world are ravaged by those who adopt a more nurture view that, you know, environment is important. And also there are the books by Cordelia Fine who say that, you know, there's no difference between men and women. By the scientists, the neuroscientists who say, well, what are you talking about? We've got clear data here that shows that there are differences between men and women. So, unfortunately, what you find is a climate of suspicion that there is some sort of agenda behind this. And you do see that there is some merit to this. The Neurogendering Project, or conference, which was sponsored last year in Sweden, was a feminist critique of the neuroscientific arguments for gender differences. So it's not to say that this is not out there. But what I would like to offer as a person of faith is that the posture with which we enter this conversation is critical. Our posture should be that of caution, that we want to make sure that we do not want to overinterpret the differences between males and females or men and women when they come out in scientific journals and blow them into something that they really aren't. But also we want to be open to the fact that perhaps there are significant differences here. So to be cautious, but also open. To be intentional about the way that we communicate these differences, recognizing that some will hear them thinking that what we are saying is, if you're a man, you're bad, you're Elmer Fudd. Or if you're a woman, you're weak because you're hormonal. We want to be very careful that those are the ears that we will be speaking to. And finally, that of compassion. That there is always respect and dignity shown to everyone, regardless of gender or neurological or genetic or whatever you want to call them differences, but to show that the image of God is inherently one that is qualitative and not continuous. And because we are all created in God's image, that the dignity is due whether you are having an IQ of 10 or an IQ of 210. You still require that dignity because God commands it. Thank you.